Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Hi, this is Ishleen. I'm the producer of the BBC World Service podcast, My Indian Life. And I just wanted to let you know that the whole of our second season is now available. From the story of the man who's desperate to be the first person on Mars, to the Kashmiri rapper making music under curfew. You'll find those and lots more brilliant stories from young people across India by searching for My Indian Life wherever you get your podcasts. Bye.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Valerie Sanderson, and at 14 hours GMT on Thursday the 6th of February, these are our main stories. Beijing has introduced tougher measures inside China to try and stop the spread of the coronavirus and has defended its handling of the crisis. The UN Security Council meets later to discuss the violence in Idlib in Syria. We find out more from our defence and diplomatic correspondent. Also,
and now after 328 days in space and 139 million miles for Christina Cook, the Expedition 61 crew is officially home.
A US astronaut has completed the longest ever single spaceflight by a woman. Plus, what's the best way to achieve equal pay for men and women? And
I'm not going to be a hey you all my life. I want to hear people call me Mister. I'm going to make something of myself.
We look back at the life of Hollywood legend Kirk Douglas, who's died at the age of 103. Despite the deaths of more than 560 people and the number of infections nearing 30,000 in China, where the coronavirus began, Beijing has insisted that it's doing all it can to contain the outbreak. In a news briefing in London this morning, Liu Jiaming, the Chinese ambassador here in Britain, said his country had taken measures far beyond international health regulations.
China is safeguarding the safety of life and health of not only the Chinese people, but also the people of the whole world. China is doing its best to safeguard global public health.
Cities across China are taking increasingly harsh measures to slow the spread of the virus. In Beijing, officials have banned group dining for birthdays and weddings. And more people stuck on a cruise liner in Japan, which is in quarantine, have tested positive for the virus. In Taiwan, mainland Chinese citizens have been banned from coming to the island. Our Asia-Pacific editor Michael Bristow says the measures there aren't a surprise.
It's certainly in line with what other countries have done. The United States, Singapore, Mongolia, Australia have all imposed restrictions on Chinese nationals and anyone who's travelled to China from coming into those countries. Even if you look across to Hong Kong, which is a semi-autonomous region of China, that's tried to cut its border with China. There are still some crossing points open, but essentially only a couple. And anyone coming from China is quarantined for 2 weeks. So it's a completely understandable, many people see, response to close your borders to China, although it's worth pointing out the World Health Organization says that countries shouldn't do this because it's not particularly effective and possibly counterproductive because people find ways of travelling anyway and they're not monitored properly if they're not coming through official crossing points.
And how are people responding somewhere like Hong Kong? Because we understand there's a bit of a rush in toilet rolls, for example.
There are. It seems a small issue, but there's been a rush on toilet rolls, other staples such as pasta and rice. And it really gives you a sense of the panic which is spreading through Hong Kong and the rest of China. The authorities in Hong Kong have said, look, don't worry. Supplies are guaranteed. They're still coming through. Don't listen to rumours on the internet. But of course, people facing such an uncertain situation as the coronavirus is, take matters into their own hands.
And tell us more about the cruise ship where more people have tested positive.
Well, yeah, as you said, there are 10 people have tested positive, nearly 4,000 people on that cruise ship. There's actually another cruise ship with a similar number of people anchored off Hong Kong. That was on a cruise to Taiwan. Taiwan refused to allow it. It's gone, sailed all the way back to Hong Kong. And across China as well, we see increasingly, as you mentioned, harsh or restrictive measures, even in Hubei province where the coronavirus began. They've even, some high-rise buildings, stopped the electricity for the lifts to discourage people from travelling outside during this time. So you can see panic in a time when the virus is still spreading.
Michael Bristow, our Asia-Pacific editor. As we record this podcast, the UN Security Council is due to hold an emergency session on Syria later today. It comes as President Assad's troops continue a major offensive in the province of Idlib in a bid to recapture the last opposition stronghold. Eight major aid agencies have called for an immediate ceasefire in the area. This man, who wished to remain anonymous, described conditions in Idlib.
Now the situation, in fact, is getting worse and worse, with no place and nowhere to go to, because all the areas now are under bombs and are under threat of being bombed again and again. People here, in fact, are mentally and psychologically destroyed because they know that the horrible situation and the bombs and the hell is going to follow them. And I'm speaking even about myself. Always my wife asks me, where should we go? I told her the only answer that I know, the only answer that I'm sure of, that I don't know. Really, I don't know, because none knows what will happen next. Borders are closed and hell is in front of us. And this is, in fact, how we think, how people here are thinking.
I asked our defence and diplomatic correspondent Jonathan Marcus more about the situation in Idlib.
Well, it's a situation that's fast turning into a humanitarian catastrophe. The UN says there are some 600,000 displaced people on the move over the last 2 months as Syrian government forces advance into the province. Remember, this is the last rebel stronghold in Syria. President Assad has pretty well taken back control over large swathes of the country. Those refugees are being pushed ever closer to the border with Turkey in the northwest, and that's one of the reasons that Turkey is so concerned about what's happening. It's already home to some 3.6 million refugees from Syria, and it doesn't want to see another wave of refugees battening on its borders to try and seek sanctuary in Turkey. So a humanitarian catastrophe, serious fighting, but also the potential for, if you like, an international fighting, international tensions between Turkey on the one hand and Damascus, the Syrian government, on the other.
So what's the aim of this UN Security Council meeting later?
Well, it would like to call on the Syrian forces to halt their advances. Remember, it's bitterly cold. It's the middle of the winter now. This is a very, very serious situation for the people caught out on the road. The problem, of course, is that the Assad government seems determined, if not to take the whole of Idlib, certainly to take key areas and key transportation routes through the province. They're backed up by the Iranians, as they have been for much of the fighting in Syria. They're backed up by Russian air power as well. And Russia's position is, of course, crucial, because Russia, as a permanent member of the Security Council, will have a decisive view in any discussions that are held this afternoon.
So anything concrete likely to emerge?
Well, I'm not sure that anything concrete will emerge. I think the other abiding concern now is that Turkey and Syria could be drawn into greater clashes. There have already been exchanges of artillery fire between Turkish troops in Idlib and the Syrians. There have been sporadic clashes on the ground, and there are real fears now that if something isn't done to draw the sting from this crisis, there could be worse fighting to come.
Jonathan Marcus. It never looked likely that the Republican-controlled Senate in the United States would impeach President Donald Trump. Despite the best efforts of the Democratic senators and one Republican, Mitt Romney, who also voted for impeachment, in the end they lacked the numbers to remove Mr. Trump from office. Our Washington correspondent, Ali McBull, watched events unfold on Capitol Hill.
It is therefore ordered and adjudged that the said Donald John Trump be, and he is hereby, acquitted of the charges in said articles.
There was no applause in the Senate chamber, but just 4.5 months after a whistleblower's concerns about a call between Donald Trump and the Ukrainian president sparked impeachment proceedings, it's all over. The trial, in effect led by Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell, didn't even call witnesses.
We will reject this incoherent case that comes nowhere near justifying the first presidential removal in history.
Donald Trump is guilty, guilty! Donald Trump is guilty, guilty!
Well, the news of that Senate vote just broke a few minutes ago, and a small protest of maybe a couple of hundred people has formed outside the Capitol building.
He lies, he's guilty, it's obvious to everyone, and the Republicans still decided to acquit him.
Donald Trump is guilty, guilty!
They may be angry, but a lot of people across this country are celebrating.
This is an important moment in our history, and I wanted to be there for it, to see our president, Donald J. Trump, acquitted.
And Amy Kramer came with her daughter all the way from Atlanta, Georgia, to be in the Senate gallery for the moment.
I'm glad it's over, but I know that the Democrats aren't going to stop.
But Amy, there are even some Republican senators who said, look, the president did do something wrong. You know, to say he's not going to send aid to a country until they start an investigation into a political opponent, that's not the right thing to do.
Wait a second. What this is really about is they cannot get over that Hillary Clinton lost. And every time they look at President Trump, they see what could have been. Hillary Clinton's never going to be our president. Get over it. Move on.
You could sense the solemnity, the seriousness of this moment.
Senator Bob Casey was one of many Democrats on Capitol Hill looking downcast. That's even though it never looked likely a Republican-led Senate would vote to remove the president.
The worry that I have is this president will not feel constrained or chastened. He'll feel emboldened. He will continue to abuse power.
There doesn't seem a great deal to salvage from this process for Democrats
at
the moment.
If someone said to me, I can predict with absolute mathematical certainty that this will be the outcome, I'd say we still should have a process that would end in a trial. The Constitution demands it.
Democrats say they had to impeach, but they also hope the Republican Party will be damaged by this acquittal. Its senators seen as subservient to the president. Only one, Mitt Romney, voted to convict him. In truth, there's been no real sense Donald Trump appears worried about the impact of the whole process at all. If anything, impeachment has become his rallying cry.
Ali Mutbul reporting from Washington. What is probably the most comprehensive study of cancer genetics has just been published. A team of 1,300 scientists from 38 countries investigated how cancers are formed and how they can be individually treated. They did this by identifying the DNA of dozens of tumours. It's taken 10 years and the researchers made new discoveries, like how strikingly different one person's cancer genome is to another. So, does it affect actual treatment? Paul Hawkins asked one of the leaders of the project, Josh Stewart, who's Professor of Biomolecular Engineering at the University of California, Santa Cruz.
I think for both, initially for cancer research, it's the most complete picture we've had of the cancer genome to date. And there's a slew of exciting discoveries just chock full in this data set that we've shared with the entire research community.
Like what?
Other people have used the analogy of a jigsaw puzzle being put together. And to extend that a little bit, it's like the puzzle has constructed a recipe book. All the cells in our body are like tiny little robot kitchens that are cooking something up, and they're following the instructions in the DNA, this recipe book. And this project has looked at the entire set of changes in the tumor's recipe book compared to the normal. And what was done before was we only really had the money and the wherewithal to look at 1% of it. And so it's kind of like looking just at the ingredient list. And now we've been able to look at all the instructions on how the ingredients are mixed together and how much. And so when we say it's a game changer, it's because we've finally read all the books from cover to cover and didn't leave anything unread.
Wow. Have you already derived then some patterns from that data that could tell you why or how cancer forms, or are you still crunching those numbers?
There has been some major new discoveries in this. And of course, we're sharing the data and hope that others will also find new patterns and connect them to treatment outcomes and so forth. To give you an idea of some of the new things, there's such a rich amount of pattern in the data. Our tissues have lots of different types of cells in them, and one cell is what leads to a cancer. And the types of changes that a cell gathers give a clue about what that original cell was. And that can actually be very important when you treat cancer. In addition, you know, the different mutagens that hit our bodies leave fingerprints in the genome, like UV light leaves a telltale sign, smoking, enzymes that go awry in our bodies, they leave particular signatures in the genome. And this study more than doubled the number of signatures. We don't know what all of them are, like we don't know what's causing those changes, but we've completed the list of the types of changes that happen from very early on in cancers, and then later in late stages. And these things actually change over time.
Wow.
So it's fascinating.
Professor Josh Stewart of the University of California, Santa Cruz, speaking there to Paul Hawkins. And still to come in this edition of our podcast.
Tim was probably the most famous elephant in the world. He was a magnificent bull elephant, and I was very lucky over the last 10 years to spend a lot of time with him.
Tim the Tusker, a renowned African elephant, has died. We'll find out why. He was a legend in the world of conservation. After 11 months, more than 5,000 orbits of the Earth and travelling over 223 million kilometres, the American astronaut Christina Cook has just completed the longest ever single spaceflight by a woman. The aim of the record-breaking mission was to help NASA better understand the effects of long-term stays in space as the agency prepares to send people to the moon in 2024. Gareth Barlow has this report.
And it looks like Soyuz MS-13 carrying Christina Cook, Luca Parmitano, and Alexander Skvortsov has touched down 3:12 a.m. Central Time, right on time.
This is the moment Christina Cook returned to Earth. The Russian Soyuz capsule landed on the steppes of Kazakhstan after undocking from the International Space Station 400 kilometres above the planet.
And now after 328 days in space and 139 million miles for Christina Cook, the Expedition 61 crew is officially home.
After spending 328 days in the inky abyss, the engineer and physicist set a new record for the longest ever single spaceflight by a woman and the second longest single flight by any American. Cook also made history when she undertook the first all-female spacewalk alongside her NASA compatriot, Jessica Meir.
When we first got the go to come out of the airlock, we were holding onto a handrail and we just caught each other's eye and we knew how special that moment was, and I'll never forget that.
NASA hasn't always been at the forefront of equality when it comes to women in space. It was only in 1983 that the first American woman escaped the pull of the planet, 22 years after the first male American astronaut, and 2 decades after the Russian cosmonaut Valentina Tereshkova became the first woman in space. After 11 months of weightlessness, multiple experiments including possible cancer treatments and karaoke nights with the crew, Christina Cook already knows what she's going to do now she's back down on solid ground.
Being outdoors is really at the top of the list. I live near the beach and I absolutely love the water, so hopefully going for a swim or a surf or just walking my dog on the beach, those are things that you can't really replicate up here, so I can't wait to be out in nature.
Christina Cook, the record-setting NASA astronaut, ending that report by Gareth Barlow. Now, is legislation necessarily the best way to achieve equal pay? Another option might be pay transparency by making employees' salaries publicly accessible. That's what one US company did. Buffer is a firm that produces a tool for managing social media accounts, and it's made data on salaries available for all to see. Katie Womersley, Buffer's Vice President of Engineering, told Carney Sharp how this is meant to make pay more equal.
We are paying people the same amount for the same job. So if you look at 2 software engineer level 3, they'll both be paid the same amount. However, if you were to look at the average salaries overall, regardless of the type of job, we do see that men earn more.
Right. Why is that?
Well, it's because men tend to hold higher paid positions on the team. Some of it is because they're longer tenured. We initially hired far more men in the early days of the company. Those men are still with us. They've been promoted. They've been successful. Whereas the newer hires are now women and they're early in their careers. So there's a bit of that tenure effect. We also noticed that our engineering team, it's still 60% men, which is quite good for technology, but it still does mean those are high paid engineering salaries. And we do see more men in engineering getting those high salaries.
So given the fact that this was introduced in 2013, it's still saying that there is a gender pay gap.
Right, there is. I mean, if you have a man and a woman doing the same job, there's no gap, but men are more likely to have higher paying jobs. That is true.
Because of the experience, and you're talking about the tenure. So that's one area that needs to be looked at, surely.
Yes, absolutely. It's a term that we call diversity debt. And that's really what happens when a company sort of retroactively goes in to fix issues surrounding how you pay people, how you promote people, who you have on your team. And it's really the longer you wait to fix something like this, the harder it's going to become. So, you know, if we had on day one equal numbers of men and women, we wouldn't have had the tenure issue we do now. And retroactively, it's quite difficult to fix because, of course, all of these men are excellent employees. They are eminently qualified. You know, we can't just fire them for being men, of course.
But how about employing women in the positions that these men have held for a really long time, or perhaps re-looking at tenure and looking at the ability to do the job, perhaps?
Right. And that is really important. It's like hiring senior women into these positions is key. So we can't just hire women into more junior roles and have everybody sort of work up from the bottom.
Indeed.
If we need to fix.
Indeed.
Have to hire more senior women.
Is that happening at Buffer? Because if they've identified that they still do have this gender pay disparity because of tenure, are they correcting that in the way in which they hire?
Extremely slowly. We don't hire very many people at senior level. So I would say yes, but it's painfully slow. It's something that, in a sense, I'm speaking out about, but also I'm the person that needs to, at this point, do something about it.
We're talking about the gender pay gap here. When it comes to hiring people from other races, how effective is Buffer in doing that?
We do have a problem when it comes to representation in leadership. We don't have any people of color in the managerial ranks or on our executive team. And that's a glaring gap that we're very aware of is urgent to fix.
Why is there a gap there as well?
Well, I would say that we started off as a very white company and we haven't diversified to the point that we need to.
Why not?
That's a really good question. We've tended to promote from within. So it goes back to the early days of the company. We weren't as aware of diversity and inclusion. It was a very white team. People were promoted from within the company. And what we saw was really the same as the story I just told you with the women. We've seen mainly men, mainly white people end up in high tenured positions of power. And that is a problem.
Yes. And whilst Buffer is trying to get ahead of this gender pay gap, when it comes to employing people of color, there is another gap. You do recognize you still have a long way to go in terms of closing those gaps.
Oh, absolutely. A hugely long way to go.
Katie Womersley from the social media development company Buffer speaking to Carney Sharp. One of Hollywood's most famous actors, Kirk Douglas, has died at the age of 103. He appeared in more than 80 films, many of them big box office hits, and he also directed and produced several films and later displayed his talent as a writer. Colin Patterson looks back at his life.
For most of his life, Kirk Douglas was driven by relentless ambition. It had its roots in his childhood in Amsterdam, New York State, where he was born Isur Danilovich, to a ragman and his wife, both Russian Jewish immigrants. The family were wretchedly poor, but as the only boy among seven children, Douglas found the lack of affection from his father something he could never forget.
My father was one of the most important factors in my life, and I realized that the key element in my life was that I never got that pat on the back from my father. I never got any feeling of approval, ever, throughout his whole life. So it made me angry.
After studying at St. Lawrence University and the Academy of Dramatic Art, Kirk Douglas arrived on Broadway, and after the Second World War made his screen debut in The Strange Love of Martha Ivers with Barbara Stanwyck. His good looks attracted much attention, but he turned down the chance to co-star with Ava Gardner in favour of a low-budget film about a boxer. Champion.
I'm not going to be a hey you all my life. I want to hear people call me Mister. I'm going to make something of myself.
As a talented wrestler, Douglas not only had the physique for the role and the personal experience, but also the raw energy. Champion won him an Oscar nomination and made him a star. He excelled in tough, ruthless roles, like the cynical journalist in Ace in the Hole.
I know newspapers backward, forward, and sideways. I can write them, edit them, print them, wrap them, and sell them.
Don't need anybody right now.
I can handle big news and little news. And if there's no news, I'll go out and bite a dog.
Kirk Douglas rejected studio bosses' requests to have his dimple removed, and it didn't prevent him from winning two more Oscar nominations, first for The Bad and the Beautiful, then for probably his best performance as the tortured Vincent van Gogh in Lust for Life.
I want to have myself committed. I want to go to an asylum. I have to feel. One more of these attacks could leave me helpless, like a crab on its back. Unable even to do away with myself.
Kirk Douglas's search for perfection made him a demanding man to work with. His dedication to his career cost him his first marriage and led him to form his own company. He was the producer and the star of the anti-war Paths of Glory and the epic Spartacus, for which he hired and credited a blacklisted writer. Despite his many achievements, he said he wasn't satisfied because that was to come to an end.
And Isser, the little boy that I think is inside me, and I think is inside everyone, especially a man, is something that becomes the quintessence of what you are.
But he faced another crisis, a stroke caused by a helicopter crash which killed two people and left Douglas traumatised. But his courage and dignity in the battle to recover his speech won him widespread admiration. Kirk Douglas had a long and happy second marriage and four successful sons, including one famous one, Michael. He also won an honorary Oscar in 1996, wrote several successful novels, and in his late 80s, he and Michael finally realised their ambition to make a film together, called It Runs in the Family.
Mom's not here to defend you? You don't know what to say? No. She was always ready to serve you. No, stop. When she was here, stop. She was excusing...
Don't talk about your mother like that.
I will talk about her any way I want, because she is my mother, and Dad, you're my father.
The voice of Michael Douglas, ending that report on Kirk Douglas by Colin Patterson. And finally, we're remembering another famous character, but this time from the animal world. In Kenya, a legend of the elephant kingdom has passed away. Big Tim the Tusker, who lived in Amboseli National Park, died aged 50 from natural causes, and his body will be preserved and put on display in Nairobi. The world-renowned photographer David Yarrow took many pictures of Tim and told Paul Hawkins what made this particular elephant so special.
Tim was one of the last 20 or 25 big tusker elephants left in Africa. All these big tuskers live in Kenya in two national parks, either Tsavo National Park or Amboseli. And there are the elephants that are kind of half elephant, half mammoth, in that their tusks reach the ground. So they're like something out of a Disney Ice Age film. They're emblematic of the fight for survival of rare species in Africa. And Tim was probably the most famous elephant in the world. He was a magnificent bull elephant, and I was very lucky over the last 10 years to spend a lot of time with him.
So how do you feel then about his passing, given that you spent so much time with him?
It's a bittersweet moment. To borrow from Dickens, it's the best of times, the worst of times. It's sad because he was a legend and he's gone. But also, I think it's a day to, in some ways, celebrate because he died of a twisted gut. He died of natural causes. And he died at 50 years old, which in elephant years is a good innings. And he lived in a place where no elephants have been poached for 5 or 6 years. And in many ways, today should be a celebration of the success of conservation rather than necessarily saying, isn't it tragic that an elephant has died? Everyone dies. And there's no tragedy here. It's just the reality that life moves on.
Yeah, it's about how we live, I guess, and how Tim lived. And I hear he was a bit mischievous, is that right?
He liked to roam. He roamed. The thing about Amboseli National Park is that there are farming communities near where he lived. And that would mean that he would sometimes move from away from the protection of where the rangers were of KWS into farmers' land and into tomato fields and potato fields. And he would be a nuisance. I was very lucky to work very closely to him. And one thing that people think that I'm really exaggerating. He might not have known me, but he certainly, I think, knew the rangers that accompanied me. So I would be able to lie on the ground within about 15 metres of an enormous elephant without feeling really any threat. And that was a fairly awesome experience.
Photographer David Yarrow on Big Tim the Tusker. He was speaking there to Paul Hawkins. And that's it from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this edition or the topics we've covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Valerie Sanderson. Until next time, bye-bye.